And now it's time for Stages.
Stages.
All the world's a stage.
It's where we talk about,
it's about all things
theatrical.
It's about theatre.
Theatre makers.
If it's performing on a stage, we've got it for you here on Stages.
It's about half an hour long.
Okay, let's get on with the show.
Yes, and it is. It's time to talk about theatre and all things theatrical. And this evening, we're kind of sitting in around the 1800s with our interviews. We're going to speak with someone from You Will Not Play Wagner, one of the performers. We'll be talking with Benedict Wall about that production. And also Between the Streetlight and the Moon, which involves Manet, a painting from him, and a possible love affair. We'll be talking to the writer there, Melita Roustan, who that play was shortlisted last year for the Patrick White Award. So we'll get into that, those very artistic kind of, you know, 1800s. We'll also have some reviews. Trish Stars has seen Chapel Perilous, and Pixie has been to see, she's been to see Chicago. So there's so much on tonight, so stay with us. I'm Regina Botros to take you through the next half an hour.
UTS is number one again, ranked as Australia's number one young university for the third year in a row. Our students agree.
UTS is such a young and energetic university. It's encouraged me to consider new paths to be ready for my industry. I think UTS has a creative and entrepreneurial approach to learning that other unis don't have, and this will make such a difference to my future study and career.
Join us for a course info evening. To learn more, go online and search UTS Course Info Night. UTS, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
And here's Trish Stars.
I've been to see The Chapel Perilous at the New Theatre, and it's running there until the 27th of May. Now, this has been written by the famous Australian poet Dorothy Hewitt and well-known feminist, and this has been directed lovingly and beautifully, I have to say, by Carissa Licciardello. Now, a lot of people don't want to stage this play. It was first staged in 1971 because Dorothy asked that there be a quite a large chorus of 30, a lot of quite difficult songs and masks and different ways of using the theatre. Now, what Carissa has done is she's pared this back and presented it very simply, so you get a really clear idea of the basic quest of the main character, Sally Banner. Now, Sally Banner, I have to say, is one of the best Australian heroines I've ever seen on stage. And she is played by the outstanding Julia Christensen. And she doesn't put a foot wrong with this role. It is absolutely fantastic. Sally Banner is a very intense young woman. And we follow her from her school days right through her love affairs, her suicide, marriage, abortion, to her love affair with communism. So it really follows Sally from the 40s through to the 60s. And what I found really amazing about this was it was still quite shocking. Even though it was set back in those days, I couldn't believe how rebellious this young woman was and how much spunk she had. I have to say that Tom Matthews, who played all of her lovers over the years, was absolutely fantastic, and he hit the nail on the head with what men were like in that era, good and bad sides of men from that era. I just love this production, and I'm sure that it's hardly ever going to be staged. So go and see The Chapel Perilous while you can at the New Theatre. This is truly an outstanding Australian production. Thanks. Bye.
You're listening to Stages. Well, that was Trish Stars there with Chapel Perilous. Opening tomorrow evening and playing at the moment at Darlinghurst Theatre is You Will Not Play Wagner. And we have one of the performers on the line, Benedict Wall, to have a chat about this production. You might have seen him in Home and Away and other television series over the last year or so. Welcome to Stages, Benedict.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, good. So, Shall we play Wagner? Well, it's a little bit too late, but the question, should we or shouldn't we? I mean, you know, this is an interesting, so he's known as an anti-Semite, if you don't know. So what? How is this play treating the issue of the art and the man, and how do we separate it?
Well, you know, I think the play really asks more questions as opposed to answering a lot.
Yeah.
But it does sort of, so we have the two protagonists of the story. One is a Holocaust survivor who is funding an orchestral competition in Tel Aviv, and the other is a young Israeli conductor who I play.
Okay.
And he wants to play Wagner, and it really becomes the battle between the two of them. Hers is really one of heart and about her experiences, and his is really an intellectual argument and also, I guess, an emotional argument in saying that Wagner shouldn't define them or shouldn't still have power over the nation.
Right.
So he's
really wanting to kind of reclaim.
Yeah, he wants to reclaim. Yeah, reclaim some identity and just sort of, yeah, not to cower away from it. And also, you know, he argues that the music's good.
Yeah.
You know?
Well.
yeah, that's his opinion. It's an interesting topic, and it's a lot of topics that I'd never dealt with myself or even heard about. So, you know, it was real education for me.
Yeah. So what did you come in when you were, like, looking, you know, researching? What did you find?
Well, there's some really interesting stuff. One of the things I thought was most interesting about the kind of, and one of the things that Yaakov is annoyed with is he feels that we've just picked this one particular issue and it's being dealt with in this way, whereas, you know, Mercedes was the car that Hitler liked, but you see Mercedes all over Tel Aviv. You know,
okay.
he has that argument. But one that I thought was really interesting is that Wagner is played on the radio.
Yeah.
So you're actually more likely to hear Wagner accidentally on the radio than if you went to a concert where it's advertised that's what they're going to play.
Yeah.
But there's something also kind of beautiful and interesting to me in the fact that it's about not creating the music on Israeli soil. And I think that, you know, so it really tells you it's an emotional argument as much as an intellectual one.
Right. So do you know much about the writing of this play?
I do, in the sense that Victor Gordon is the
playwright,
South African. And he's just flown over, actually, to see it. And he's written a few other pieces, but I think this is the first time, definitely the first time this play is being produced.
Okay.
And I'm not sure about his work elsewhere.
So are you playing it on stage?
Playing the Wagner?
Yeah.
No. we allude to it.
Okay.
But no, there is no Wagner on stage. We'd have to warn everyone if there was, because we have a lot of the Jewish community coming. And
right.
Like we say, a lot of people don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
But believe me, you're going to get some very pro-Wagner arguments.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what are the sort of some of the things? And are we just sticking with him, or are we actually going out? Because, you know, this is sort of coming up with artists and all kinds of, you know, other people that aren't necessarily nice people, but they're art. And, you know, do you kind of go into that other world and the greater world of other artworks?
Not so much. I mean, I think the arguments are universal in that sense. And I mean, I, as an actor, I kind of, my point of view is actually quite close to Yaakov's, where I really tend to separate art and artists.
Yeah.
Because I think as more time goes on, you know, the aspects of their personal life kind of fall away. But you know, a lot of people have the other side of things and don't want to see work from people that they don't think is sort of, I don't know, morally up to scratch. Because, you know, I guess when you remove those people, it makes space for others.
Yeah.
You know, that dominance, maybe they don't deserve that space. I personally, like, I'm trying to think of people who, Roman Polanski's a perfect example.
Yes.
I really like Chinatown, but I also know he's guilty of a very serious crime. How do you feel about that?
Yeah.
Do you think? But I also wonder, you know, should we be denied these amazing parts, you know, the one good thing they've done? You know, is it punished? Who does it punish, I guess, is part of the question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got you as a student, and then can you set the scene for?
Okay, so the play it all takes place in
contemporary
in Tel Aviv in 2000.
Okay,
And we're there in there's something I won't tell you about, because when they come to the play, there is a nice big twist,
reveal.
Like all good plays,
okay.
A reveal. but essentially, what happens is the the orchestral, so the person organising the competition, who's an American, has come with the sort of patron of the competition. And after the Yakov and five other conductors make the finals, they find out that Yakov has decided he's going to play Wagner in the final, and there's no rule in the competition saying that he can't.
Oh.
And there's a history in Tel Aviv, in Israel in general, especially I think 1981, someone tried to play it, Netta, I think, tried to play it. And there were huge protests. People went up on stage and, you know, tried to take the baton out of his hand.
Really?
So it really isn't played. It's a really hot topic issue. And so they know that that could conceivably destroy the competition. So they bring Yakov into their offices to try and talk some sense into him. And he's kind of an affable character to start with. He's just got a happy-go-lucky, but I think that's kind of an act in itself to and sort of put them off their game. And it becomes, you know, they get into the nitty-gritty of why it's important and their own personal beliefs. And Yakov is a third-generation survivor. You know, his grandparents came out of the camps, and so he's got a very specific personal relationship with the ideas around the music as well.
Right, so he's not divorced from it.
I think he kind of, at first, definitely starts off as an intellectual argument, but as you get deeper into his motivations, you see that there's actually quite a deep emotional reasoning as well.
Yeah. And does he go, is there that sort of transformation? Are any minds changed throughout the play?
I think there is. As much as minds changed, I think the two lead characters are brought very close together, even though their points of view are the dichotomy between their points of view. They actually are drawn to one another, and one is, you know, a woman in her late 70s and one is a guy in his late 20s. So there's 50 years between them, and they manage to kind of strike up this unlikely friendship through their complete antagonism to one towards one another. Which is interesting, you know, in itself.
Terrific. Well, Benedict, thank you so much for joining us.
No worries at all. Thank you so much for your time.
A play about, well, with no answers, but lots of questions and things to discuss after, it sounds like.
And a couple of little answers and a mystery. It's not all
this stuff. Oh, other things. Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. You Will Not Play Wagner is playing at the Darlinghurst Theatre until the 28th of May. Get along and see it. Yeah, lots of discussion in there. Here's a Tad Mulry gang playing at the Basement on Friday evening.
I'll be round to get you in a taxi. We'll be right back.
Ted Mowry again. Oh, with a little bit of something else going on in the background there. You're listening to Stages, where we're talking about theatre and all of that sort of stuff. And Pixie Willow has been out to the theatre. Pixie.
Last Saturday, I took my children to see Chicago at the Joan Sutherland Performing Arts Centre in Penrith. Although mostly a young cast, I'm so excited to have stumbled across the Penrith Musical Comedy Theatre. These guys are bursting with talent, sincerity, and fabulous energy, and they literally blew my socks off with their innovative and often gymnastic choreography. As well as a few unexpected twists, including at one point a Harley Davidson driven across the stage. Each actor was clearly having a whale of a time and spot on with delivery, timing and vocal precision, particularly from Jeff Sefai, who plays the notorious lawyer Billy Flynn. No, he wasn't George Clooney, but he certainly gave him a run for his money. This production is being shown at the Concert Hall at the Joan and will be playing until the 13th of May. There was also live music from Bonnie Songs before the performance on Friday the 12th, so get your tickets while they're hot.
Lipschitz. And now, the six merry murderesses of the Cook County Jail in their rendition of The Cell Block Tango.
Well, open last night at the King's Cross Theatre is Between the Streetlight and the Moon, and we have the writer in the studio with us to have a chat about it. Melita Ralston, welcome to Stages.
Thank you for having me.
So this was the shortlisted last year out of 131 or 161 plays, 131 entries for the Patrick White Award at, run through STC, Sydney Theatre Company. How long have you been working on it, this production?
Oh, well, it's a... People kind of get a little shocked sometimes when I say it, but I guess that's part of the artistic process. The idea actually came to me in 2010,
okay,
which is a while ago, when I was travelling through Paris. And It was one of those things where I thought, that could be a really interesting subject for a play. You know, file it in the back of your head.
A little.
And, keep your eye out for information about Bert Morisot and Edouard Manet, the two dead French painters.
So, yeah, you're in Paris.
Yeah, okay. I'll
what happened? Yes. The scene, you're in Paris.
I'm in Paris. I had just finished my master's in creative writing at UTS, and I felt I deserved a little prize. So I booked myself a studio in Montmartre in Paris, where those wonderful impressionist painters lurked the streets and had their studios, and obviously all the cliches and magic and mystery of Paris, the Moulin Rouge, all of that sort of stuff.
The romance.
And I basically gave myself a month to soak it up, become a local, walk the streets, write in my notebook, seek things out and hopefully become inspired.
Yeah.
And I did, which is good.
That happened. You've got something there. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was basically, I was at the Musée d'Orsay the first time I'd been there. And it's famous for all the big, beautiful Impressionist paintings.
All the masters.
And Edouard Manet was someone I studied at art school. His famous Olympia, which caused a stir in 1865 because while everyone was painting nudes all the time, she was a well-known prostitute. And in the painting, she actually returns the viewer's gaze. She kind of stares at you as if to say, what are you looking at?
Yeah.
And she's also got her hand very firmly clasped on her Lady bits. We won't do any trigger warnings for this interview.
I know.
And I loved that painting because of the idea that she was in control of her. She was her sexuality and she was saying, you know, this is who I am and like it or lump it kind of thing. So I wanted to go and see that. And while I was there, this other little painting in the same room was on the corner of the wall and I was fascinated with it. And it was very small, very sketchy, what we call abstract expressionist nowadays, back in 1865, not a thing at all. And it was intimate in the sense that I knew this was in his studio, in his room. There's a little heater on the floor. There's a cupboard. And there's a woman, most importantly, sitting there staring at him through the spokes of her fan. She's covering her face. And basically her gaze and the way she cocks her foot as well. She has this pink slipper on, which is the same slipper Olympia wore. And it's sort of dangling. And I knew for a fact that women at that time were always chaperoned. There's no way a woman of her stature, bourgeoisie, would have been allowed to be alone with this man in such an intimate setting. But it looked like she was. And the look, wow. So I wanted to know firstly who she was, Bert Morisot, the one of the only women impressionist painters who made a career. And he painted 11 portraits of her.
Right.
And all of them have a kind of intimacy, electricity. There's things going on. And the paint, I feel, it courts the charts the course of a really full-on relationship because towards the end of the relationship that no one can prove, the paint gets heavier and thicker and angrier. So it's almost as if he's expressing his feelings for her through the process of the way he applied the paint. And I just found that so fascinating. And, yeah, when I looked into it, there was no kind of academic art history about them having an affair or they just said they were friends. He was married and a couple of years later she married his brother.
So you, what you've done is taken this story or this possible kind of relationship but also set it now with a parallel kind of story going on.
So basically the lead, Zadie, played by the lovely Lucy Miller, she is an academic who once was a painter, gave up painting, and we discover that one of the reasons she gave up painting was that she had an affair with her mentor, a famous artist. So there we have that mirroring of that relationship. And for her, her academic life has been about trying to prove this, the value of this artistic relationship between the two dead painters. And, of course, as she goes on that journey, she's coming to terms with her past.
Her own. In some ways I felt, they're kind of this longing for a truth or a reality or but the complexity and the puzzles. I really love, what I love about art and what comes up in this is all of the symbolism in art and the, you know, the flowers or the, you know, colours used. Is this sort of, are you drawing on your past as a student of, you know, art as well as writing, creative writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love art history and I still love going to galleries and exploring what people are doing with paint. I think the historical element for me in the paintings does give us those narrative clues, if you like, and I'm always fascinated by that, especially when you start going deep and learning about an era and what life was like, and the fact that these artists were, for the first time, painting what they saw around them, which was a very radical idea at
shift
the time.
In the,
And so
Zadie is going basically on a search, or she has it in her mind that there's something exists to prove this. So there is kind of a, how did you, is that real? Is there a letter? I don't know. Tell us a little bit about what I'm talking about.
The paintings are real, obviously. Yeah. And there is one painting where it's that, those beautiful symbols you talk about. So he paints a bunch of violets, which in the 19th century Paris represented a love affair. Mm-hmm. And he paints Bertie's red fan, which she, obviously the picture I talked about, and a few other paintings, she's holding the same fan. Mm-hmm. And then he also paints a letter that is addressed to her, signed by him, but it's folded, so you can't see what's written in there.
Right.
But you're looking at these kind of, you know, and what a fan was for women. Like, every woman had a fan at that time, and how they used it, you know, coquettishly or to, you know, symbolise if they were available or unavailable, that sort of thing. Mm. So then the fiction takes place where I said, what if that letter was found?
Mm.
Hey, what would it say? Mm. And I mean, I think there's, someone was saying to me last night that they had, they were older, so pre-email generation, and found a box of letters in their attic from when they were in their 20s, and they were love letters and all sorts of letters, and how that, that there's a beautiful kind of romance, but magic to that sort of thing, and seeing
intimacy.
Yourself reflected back at you at a different age, and how this generation, out, you know, won't have that anymore. So there's something just so delightful about the idea of traces of yourself being kept or lost or proving things or making things more complex. Yeah.
There is that sort of public and private thing going on. I mean, in some ways, the Zadie, the character, wants to prove something and make it public, but in another way, what you're talking about is this intimacy and this sort of, you know, can never be really understood. Is that something for her as well? Will she ever really understand her choices? Zadie is the, you know, with her ex-mentor and her new life.
Yeah, I hope that comes across. I'm just making sure I'm not giving away plot points.
Yeah, no.
But I do play a bit with the idea of memory.
Yeah.
And what one, and you know, we can talk about a conversation that happened last week, and we'll both have a different experience of it. Mm. So that idea of what one person thought happened versus the other, and perception. And I guess I'm hoping that's what the script does. It opens up these questions about the complexity of relationships, and instead of closing it down, and because I've had a few interviewers say, "Well, did they have an affair? Did you prove it?" And,
yeah, right. Give me an answer.
And I think what's interesting is more about what is opened up in that question, as opposed to closing it down and saying, tick the box, yes, they had an affair, but why was that such a complex relationship? What did it mean?
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So, and also let's quickly mention the streetlight and the moon. Mm. And what happens in between? Is that sort of partly what you're saying,
that,
in fact?
It is. It is indeed that, I don't know, we all spend our lives reaching for some sort of goal, whether it's that, you know, I'm going to sound like a cliche now, but that promotion or the great house or, and is, you know, and sometimes you always say, oh, it was a bit of an anticlimax. I got what I wanted, you know. Mm. And so I think the between is the journey of getting there.
Yeah.
Is
the difference between
more interesting. Or also
the dream.
I guess it reverberates on a variety of levels, but you know, sometimes it's okay to be between things as well. Or,
well,
you know,
once you reach there, I suppose that's possibly the end or something like that. Anyway, we're almost out of time. Alita Rowson, thank you so much for joining us here in the studio. There's so much more in this play that we won't talk about because you've got to get there and see it. All of that sort of, you know, about the women and the, you know, are we, you know, creative freedom, how that's changed or maybe it hasn't changed, and other little surprises that we, some visual surprises. Directed by Anthony Skews with a great cast. Tell us the cast.
Mm. Azades, and finally the wonderful Lani Tupu playing Jeff, the man who broke Zadie's heart.
Also with live piano.
Oh, yes.
Music.
And Ben.
Gorgeous.
Oh, my God. Benjamin Freeman plays live jazz.
Melita, thank you. Between the Streetlight and the Moon, King's Cross Hotel, only to the 27th of May. I'm Regina Botchos. This has been Stages. We'll see you next week.